The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, why we should stop hating and instead learn to love meteorites.
There are absolutely no recorded instances of anybody being killed by a meteorite, even though some people have been hit by them.
It turns out they might actually be good for us.
The disturbance of an ecological environment is actually very good for biodiversity.
But on the other hand, it's probably still worth keeping an eye out for one.
It could render much of the human species extinct.
We dive into the secret world of leatherback turtles.
I like the one called Darwinia, who clocked up a 1,000-metre dive.
We discuss a scientist's worry that small-scale drug makers are piggybacking on his cutting-edge research to dangerous ends.
There was one substance that they didn't study and didn't publish on because it was incredibly toxic.
And we put our walking boots on and dodge the traffic as we take a tour around some of the most famous roads in medicine.
On this site is the site of where Florence Nightingale worked, set up the nursing profession as we know it today.
We look at the history of London's Harley Street.
I suspect that makes a great deal of people's money, plastic surgery here, and all sorts of plastic surgery as well.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone, and a happy new year to you all. Think of a meteor, any meteor. It's not the kind of thing you'd normally consider hugging. I guess these huge balls of ice and rock more usually are associated with death and destruction. But it turns out they've been getting a bad press. They could actually be vital for helping life on Earth.
My name is Ted Neild. I'm the editor of Geoscientist magazine and the author of this book.
Ted, you better tell us the title of your book.
Yeah, so the book is called Incoming, or Why We Should Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Meteorite.
Ted has been giving his unorthodox view to our very own Robin McKee, who began by asking what would happen if an asteroid hit the Earth tomorrow.
The amount of energy that's released by an object travelling at the cosmic velocity hitting the Earth. Most of the films that show this, some of them quite good special effects, but they all of them inevitably underestimate the speed of these things. I mean, if something is travelling at, say, 30, 40 kilometres per second, when it hits the top of the atmosphere, it's landing on concrete anyway, because something travelling that fast even finds the upper atmosphere solid.
Right.
So it immediately starts to vaporise, and it releases practically all its mass is then transferred into energy, which is then transferred into the atmosphere, and of course into the crust and into the ocean, everything that it hits. So Gene Shoemaker used to say it's like turning... and he's talking about an American oven, but if he's like turning an oven up to broil, that's what it would be like. Yeah. And so for a large proportion of the Earth, something 10 kilometers across would probably render, it would depend on what latitude it hit at, exactly how the effects propagated around the globe. But you'd be talking about rendering large areas of the globe, possibly a hemisphere, well, uninhabitable. And within the blast zone, nothing would survive, because when these things hit, it's just vapor, plasma, and incredible temperatures, which nothing could survive.
And what follows on? I mean, would there be any prospect of human survival?
It could render much of the human species extinct. Whether it would do all of them, of course, is another matter. It's quite possible.
Right.
It depends how large, it depends what latitude, and it depends how many, how widely distributed around the globe human beings are.
Yes.
Because we're extremely widely distributed now, but very small populations might not survive in the aftermath, which could last thousands, tens of thousands of years. It would take hundreds of thousands of years for the Earth to recover from something like that. Unlike with a megavolcano, there is at least a science fiction scenario. It is science fiction, but at least it's envisageable, where you could actually do something about an incoming asteroid if you saw it sufficiently far in advance.
The European Space Agency's got a project for that, hasn't it?
That's right. And there are, I mean, all the Hollywood films, of course, suggest sending a big bomb, because all Hollywood films have to end with a big bang.
Yes.
To create the proper dramatic climax. That would probably be a very silly thing to do, but you could attach You could attach little ion engines which could divert the asteroid right. over several orbits, and you could, if you knew what its orbit was sufficiently far in advance, you could, theoretically at least, send something there, attach it to the surface, which would cause just a very, very slight deviation.
And why would putting a bomb on it, we're talking an atom bomb here, a hydrogen bomb, why would that be bad?
Well, because then you'd probably be hit by three fairly lethal things instead of one very lethal thing, and there's no particular reason why that should be a good thing.
Do you think we were afraid of meteorites?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's time we started to realise that the Earth is a complex system, and that there can be no single possible effect from a thing like a meteorite landing. It might be good, it might be bad, but the meaning of an event takes its meaning from the context in which it arrives, and that's the sort of the point of the book, really. But yes, I do think that the meteorites had a bad press. I suppose because it's one of those things that everybody knows. The dinosaurs were killed by a meteorite. And since 1980, when that hypothesis first broke onto the public scene, it's been immortalized in movies, and everybody knows it. And even if it were to turn out to be wrong, I don't think we'd ever shift it from people's minds now. It's in there. First of all, no one's ever been killed by a meteorite, as far as we know. There are absolutely no recorded instances of anybody being killed by a meteorite, even though some people have been hit by them. There is a legend, too, about a dog being struck by them, the famous Nakla dog. But this was probably a myth created by the Wali of a neighbouring village that wanted to cash in on the publicity for the meteorite fall itself. So the Nakla dog, sadly, even though everyone's very fond of the Nakla dog, is probably another myth.
So we have nil humans killed and one disputed dog.
And one disputed dog.
It's not much of a death list, is it?
Not really, no. And also the fact that we've been monitoring near-Earth asteroids now for quite a time. We've probably mapped getting up for 70% of the big ones, and there isn't one, despite all the warnings that we had in the early days, mm-hmm. there isn't one that stands the remotest chance of hitting us in the near future. So our chances of dying by meteorite, sort of global chances of dying by meteorite, these are globalized figures, so, yeah. You can compare them with the globalized risk of, say, dying by aeroplane accident, and that would come out with a figure that would apply to you and me, and equally to a tribesman in Borneo who will never even set foot in an airport. So the global odds now have been reduced just by having mapped these things to something like mm-hmm. the chances of dying by firework. And that is something like one in 700,000. And even on Bastille Day in the middle of Paris, when one is more acutely aware than one might otherwise be of the possibility of dying by firework, most people remain calm.
I would have thought, actually, the odds were even less than that, because I mean, if nobody's ever been killed by a meteorite, it's kind of, well...
Yes, but there's always the possibility that a big one might hit us, in which case half the planet might get wiped out. Right. So it rather affects the probability calculations.
How do you rate that probability of us being smacked by something dinosaur size, if you know what I mean?
Well, it looks pretty much nil in the foreseeable future at the moment. Doesn't mean we should stop looking at the skies, though, of course, because there might be one out there that's got our name on it.
Yes.
Although we know that one mass extinction, and only one mass extinction, has been linked at least partly to a major meteorite hit. But some new research that started in Sweden way back when I was a research student, it's quite a long time ago now, but when it was first realised that they'd found a fossilised meteorite in some Ordovician rocks, which are about 450 million years old, that there was an enormous bombardment of the Earth at that time, lasting possibly 10 million years, mm-hmm. when the meteorite flux went up to way, way beyond what it is now. That's now been observed in rocks of the same age all over the world.
Yeah.
And what this seems to suggest is that this might be an explanation for a hitherto unexplained feature of the fossil record, which is something that's been given this jaw-cracking name of the Great Ordovician Biodiversity Event, which I shall now call the GOBE. The GOBE. Now, because the GOBE is something that was discovered when people started putting fossil data into computers, and that of course revealed all the extinction events.
Yes.
But what it also revealed was something that nobody actually noticed before, which is this biodiversification event which happens in the middle Ordovician. And that has been completely unexplained, because there was no particular reason for it to happen. It wasn't a rebound from a previous extinction, which is the only thing that it's comparable with. And it is indeed comparable in scale to the great biodiversification event which happened at the beginning of the Cambrian, when complex life first developed. But this is mostly at species and genus level, so it's not the evolution of great body plans that give us the present day animal phyla. It's at a species and genus level,
and that's linked to kind of increased meteorite activity.
The idea is that if you have sublethal bombardment.
Sublethal bombardment. Yeah. That's a sort of American army phrase, isn't it?
Well, we could call them limited theatre, if you like. Yeah, limited theatre bombardment, where instead of completely incinerating the globe, a bombardment, say, would sterilise an area a few hundred kilometres across. This would be a major ecological disturbance, but it wouldn't be lethal to any particular species. And what it would do would be to free up space. It's a little-known fact, part of the sort of theory of ecology, that the disturbance of an ecological environment is actually very good for biodiversity. You see it in reefs, and in fact, that's what I was doing in Sweden when I was a research student. I was looking at reefs that were in gradually shallowing water. And the moment that a reef hits wave base and starts to get smashed up by storms, at that point you get an enormous diversification.
So this was the equivalent, this was the meteorite.
This would be an equivalent.
Acting like a wave on a reef.
Creating new niches. So it's like putting a quarry in the middle of an area that has no cliffs. You suddenly get a man-made cliff, and you have all the species that live on cliffs suddenly moving into the area, increasing the local biodiversity. Right. And gravel pits do the same thing when they flood, and then you get all the species that inhabit the lake and so on. A physical disturbance of an environment can actually increase the habitats available, can therefore, and it breaks the stranglehold of certain species which occupy space and stop other species from getting in.
So that's really why we should be, that's an argument for why we should be grateful to the meteorite. That's what it's done for us.
Well,
in the sense that it made the Earth's ecology more complex and enriched it.
Yes, that's right. In fact, until 1980, we were always grateful for the fact that the dinosaurs were no longer around. Because if it hadn't been for whatever it was that killed them off, then we wouldn't have evolved. Those little trembling mammals in their burrows would never have come out and would never have evolved into us.
Yes.
And then, of course, suddenly when the impact hypothesis came along, we started to be less grateful for the disappearance of the dinosaurs, because we had another thought, which was, well, maybe the same thing that happened to them could happen to us. The idea that you can be completely wiped out by a random event is not as reassuring as the thought that you have evolved into what it is that you are, and that, because evolution in a way kind of makes everybody aristocracy, because you can always say, well, we're better than the people that went before.
Yes.
We're better than the creatures that were more adaptable. Yes. And therefore we survived. It gives you a reason for being. But of course, no amount of evolution can prepare you for a 10-kilometer asteroid landing on your head. So that's a very unsettling thought. And so instead of suddenly being grateful that they were all wiped out, we started to worry that maybe the same thing one day might happen to us. Now, that's a sensible thing to be worried about. Of course, it's why we started to look at the heavens and try and map these very dark objects.
Just how responsible was that great meteorite that landed in the Yucatan? I've forgotten how many million years ago it was. 64, 65, thank you.
I mean, nobody seriously doubts that there was a major impact at the end of the Cretaceous. Whether it was the one that created the crater in Yucatan, the Chicxulub crater, is another matter and something of a side issue, because we found a very big crater. Is it the smoking gun? People investigating this think that it is. There's a small and vociferous minority that think that it's too old, 300,000 years too old, in fact. But that's hotly disputed. I mentioned it in the book, but it is something of a side issue.
Can you see the crater, or is it?
No, you can't.
It's buried, isn't it?
It's offshore and it's buried. In fact, it was discovered by oil geologists working for Pemex, which is the Mexican oil company. They originally found it, and it was all proprietary data, and it was not released until rather later. But they found the structure through geophysical prospecting, basically.
Yes.
And they found the circular structure and the gravity anomalies. And because it was conveniently close to the United States, where all the interest was, which was rather good. But the whole thing has been linked up. Most people believe that that is the crater representing the impact of the end Cretaceous impactor.
Ted Neild there, talking to the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. His book, Incoming, is out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Happy New Year to everyone. And in the studio, still clutching their geeky Christmas presents, are Nell Bowes, the Guardian Science correspondent, Ian Sample, as well as Robin McKee, the Observer's Science Editor. Hello to you all. Can I ask you before we go on, what Christmas presents did you get?
I got fantastic. I got electric salt and pepper grinders. Fantastic.
That's true.
It was so great fun. I've been grinding all Christmas.
Oh, dear.
That's a horrible thought. Mel, raise the tone slightly. Did you get like a microscope? Or
I
a
actually
telescope
did
or
get quite a geeky present. I got a radio controlled clock,
oh.
Which I really liked.
What, you mean you can start and stop it from a distance?
No. It's radio controlled, so it keeps itself in time. And when the clocks go forward, it just automatically, it's quite eerie when you turn it on, the hands automatically start moving at the correct time.
Not a digital thing.
No.
That's really weird.
Old school analog.
You can't fly it or
no, although obviously anywhere. I'm going to customise it so that we can fly it this
Pimp
weekend.
It up.
Yeah, pimped clock.
I got some excellent gravity-defying socks that are made of such exquisite wool from somewhere off the internet that they stand up on their own. So it's they're like having.
You're trying to make it cool, but you got socks.
I got Christmas socks. I got Christmas socks, but they're so thick that I only realised this after using them like for 3 days on end.
So is that
when you take them off, when you take them off, you put them down, and they retain not only your foot shape, but they stand up as well. So next morning, you can just almost jump up and land into them.
Do you not change your socks every day?
Not these socks.
You can't wear socks 4 days in a row.
No, you can if you're only wearing them just until you've had your first coffee, and then you know. Do your normal shower and get ready, and you change into your day socks.
Oh, I see.
What did you get, Alec?
Got something which I'm not a massive believer of Christmas, but I did get a really quite a nice geeky present. I got a Zed boson. Actually,
just one.
Just a big. It's a big red thing. It's slightly heavier than the Higgs. I think we discovered this morning.
It's much heavier than the Zed boson. Is so heavy, it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's it's right. Like, yeah,
that's it's one of the it's one of the doesn't travel. It's if anyone, contact force.
If you want to know, it's basically the heavy version of the photon that basically
just
transmits the weak nuclear force in nuclei. But it's cool. It's got a smile and everything. I liked it very much. That's genuine. No, that really is a genuine present. We're going to move on to the stories now, I think. We're going to start off with a very serious one. This is about how a chemist writing in Nature is worried about how his research might be misused. Ian, take us through this.
So this is a synthetic chemist called David Nichols, who works at the at Purdue University in Indiana. And he was writing in Nature last week about his experiences of how his own work seems to be used by sort of underground chemists, if you like, to produce what generally get called legal highs. These are the sort of drugs that are abused, which aren't yet banned or aren't banned at all.
They're too new to have been rated and tested and put onto the sort of government's classification list.
Yeah, exactly. So if you go to, head shops or wherever, and if you just ask around in the right places, the list of drugs that are available, and the names become ever more sort of elaborate and sometimes seem to get sort of almost parodies of themselves. But anyway, there's a huge proliferation of names of these drugs. And a lot of them are, as you say, they're just so new, such new compounds, that the legal framework hasn't had a chance to catch up and even work out if they should be banned or not.
So give us some examples of these things.
Well, what was interesting, particularly, I thought, from this guy's point of view, first of all, this chemist was tipped off in an email he got from a colleague, which actually was sending him an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal late last year, where the reporters had talked to a couple of guys who basically set themselves up as chemists that produce street drugs. And they knew what they were doing. They would look through the chemistry literature. They would find research articles about psychoactive drugs that weren't the ones we're familiar with, like LSD and things like that. And they would make them. They would tinker with them. And they'd try and turn them into pills. And then they would just start selling them. And what was pretty alarming for this guy was in this article, one of the these chemists said, David Nichols has been basically particularly useful for us. We follow his papers very avidly.
He's just doing his science and publishing like any scientist should. And you've got very science literate sort of drug dealers sort of adapting them and making them. But Robin, what do you think about the responsibilities of chemists like David Nichols in making sure that teenagers and older people, in fact, are not being harmed by their work?
It's a very difficult one, this. I mean, what does he do? Does he stop doing research that has potentially extremely useful medical benefits because of the danger, or does he refuse to publish, in which case there's not much point in doing the research because people don't know what it is he's doing, for fear that somebody might misuse his results? It's one of those imponderables, I would have thought. I can't see a way out of it, obviously.
The point is not to go into restricting research or not publishing or putting barriers to what kinds of research papers you have access to. It's more towards education of the public, of the people who are taking these legal highs and going, do you know what, it's a legal high, that means absolutely nothing in terms of safety. Because there's a perception, it's not illegal, and it must be okay.
This is a problem with the drug classification system in general, isn't it? The actual ABC rating doesn't tell you actually how dangerous something is at all. It's about what the Daily Mail tells you is.
If you're buying something off the back of a lorry not from a legal retailer, then you're going to come across
some teenagers making
dangerous.
It with another teenager, and you know, one of them offers them a pill. Do you say, "Oh, is this being regulated by NICE?"
A lot of this stuff is sold as herbal ecstasy, for example, and herbal makes it sound harmless, doesn't
it?
I mean, Ian, what does David Nichols think should happen? I mean, he's raised this issue. He talks about feeling very. How this stuff haunts him.
I want to make one point, which is that there's a chance that people can hear stories like this discussed in the media and think that it's media whipping up a load of hype about something that isn't actually happening. And I think it's worth heading that off in that in the 1980s, David Nichols became aware of this problem firsthand when he was working on drugs similar to MDMA, so ecstasy. Now, he published three papers looking at the use of these drugs in animals, and within a fairly short space of time, that drug was on the market. It was being sold as a pill called Flatliners, and sadly, some people who took it died. And the idea being that they died probably from taking very high doses of that drug, but they died from taking it nonetheless. And he writes in his piece, "I had published information that ultimately led to human death." And he says that what his real fear ongoing is that as he publishes work on other sort of psychoactive substances that might be of use clinically, that it's not that, you know, some of these underground chemists, they might get hold of a substance, try it in a few people, everybody's fine, so they think it's okay. That is almost their FDA equivalent. You know, that is their safety test. But he's saying that with so many of these things, you could easily have, say you get a hit, whereas one of these drugs becomes incredibly popular and millions of people start taking it every weekend. What if 10 years down the line, it turns out that they now have irreversible kidney damage that turns out to be untreatable and fatal? It's not going to come up in any kind of just quick, you know, it's not going to be an immediately acute problem. And that's the fear. But in terms of an answer, he doesn't particularly have one. He has self-censored. He said that there was one substance that they didn't study and didn't publish on because it was incredibly toxic. And if they'd published and someone had taken it almost just as a to see if it was worth exploring, then they probably would have been killed, you know, by taking
that.
He's self-centered. He's not very happy about having done that. But it's like, what is the scientist to do in this situation? I think the answer for me is not one that comes naturally, but this whole idea that we need to know whether a drug is safe or a drug is evil before we ban it. Surely, like with every other drug, you need to prove it's safe before it's able to be taken. And I don't know how something can go onto the market and not be legal straight away by default. I mean, surely it should be almost be illegal until it's proved safe.
Anyway, let's move on to something a bit more optimistic. Nell, leatherback turtles, the ancient mariners of the ocean.
This is a lovely story by a team from Exeter who have finally succeeded in tracking these leatherback turtles who are born on the coast of West Africa and poodle around the ocean, heading over as far as South America.
Poodle around? 5,000 miles is not poodling around anywhere.
5,000 miles. It's an they make these incredible journeys.
How did they do it?
So they had a little satellite transmitter that they glued onto the back of 25 leatherback turtles. It's powered just by four little camera batteries. And they've tracked the journeys of these 25 leatherbacks across the ocean. There seem to be three sort of main routes. There's one that goes right across from Gabon over to the coast of South America. There is a group that stays hanging around in the northern part of the Atlantic. And then there's a group that heads further down south. And they seem to be tracking areas of really high nutrition in the ocean.
One of them, I think, all the 25 that they tracked, they're all females. One of them went in such a straight line from its birthplace
in
Gabon to sort of off the coast of Brazil and Uruguay in such a straight line that actually it would have baffled most modern seafaring equipment to go that straight. It's
I've made that
crazy
journey by boat, and it's a long way.
You've made that journey by boat?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
This is something I didn't know. Did you go in a straight line? Did you end up?
No, it's a lot more wiggly than
so
is it Tika?
Is
Tika
it?
Was the name of the turtle, I believe.
So it's quite difficult, is it?
Yeah.
So I was just interested in how fast they're going. How quickly do they move, and how do they deal with all these underwater ocean currents?
Well, for the first few years of their life, they simply waft along with the current, and it's only after a few years that they develop the ability and the strength in order to fight and to head off on these incredible journeys, such as Tika's across from Gabon to Uruguay. And how fast do they go? Well, on average, 6 months, 5,000 miles, what's that? 30 miles a day.
Good acting. You know you've worked this out before.
about a knot, about a nautical mile
an
hour.
A knot is what in metric?
It's a mile and a half. No, I don't know. I'm making it up. It's an average speed.
A mile and a half.
No, a mile an hour. Roughly
an hour.
Yeah. Nautical
it's
mile
not
an
very
hour.
Very quick, is it?
Yeah, but
oh, come on, sailing boats
months.
Only go about 6 nautical miles
So I don't know if they're
hour.
Going with the currents or against the currents.
Well, probably,
or whatever.
Well, that's an average joke, isn't it?
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, yeah.
Well, just before we finish up that one, I mean, just all of these turtles were named by the researchers, and you can actually track them if you like. If you go to seaturtle.org, you can track all of these turtles in real time and even adopt one. And see, for example, one of them called Caroline, who's the actual
champion
swimmer.
Yeah. She's
called
up Caroline. 7,000 miles.
7,000 miles over a year and a half of just swimming around the middle of the Atlantic.
I like the one called Darwinia, who clocked up a 1,000-metre dive.
1,000 metres
dive.
Which
is just extraordinary.
None of this means anything to me. I don't sail. Is 1,000 metres a lot?
It's very meters. 1,000 metres, yeah. Well, yes, that's deep down there. A lot of pressure.
Okay. Fine. Well, clearly these are impressive creatures.
Very impressive.
And we love them. Okay, Ian, tell us about your experience with females crying around you. Women crying around you.
I'll skip that and instead talk about something far more interesting, which is some research by a team at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. And they were looking for what they call chemical signals in tears. And there's a nice idea behind this, because humans are widely thought to be the only animals that produce emotional tears, as distinct from sort of protective tears where the eye is just flushing itself because you've got a bit of grit in it, or you're going down a hill on your bike and it's really windy or something else only humans tend to do, actually. one thing that's known is that the chemical composition of emotional tears is different to the chemical composition of these more reactionary reflex tears. So you think, well, there are some instances in the animal world where drops of liquid produced by lacrimal glands, which are basically tears, contain sort of chemical signaling, type pheromone-type chemicals, which are supposed to influence the behavior of others around the animal. So these guys thought, okay, what the heck? We'll go and have a look and see if we can find sort of some purpose for why we cry emotional tears, because you have to think about what on earth use is it in crying.
This is a really long setup to essentially
what the
money shot.
So so these guys got a science paper out of this whereby they showed that when men sniffed liquids without the woman being there, the tears were collected by sitting women in a sealed room watching weepy movies. They collected the tears rolling down their cheeks, and then the men were tested by sniffing them or sniffing saline. They didn't know what they were sniffing. They didn't even know that tears were an option, and their sexual arousal dropped. Also, their testosterone as measured in their saliva dropped.
Are you saying that crying women turns men off? No, this sounds like such a tabloid story.
It doesn't turn them off. It turns off their sexual drive.
It reduces. Yeah, I mean, it basically, in the test that was done, the men who sniffed the tears found women's faces less sexually appealing after doing so. Let me tell you something a bit more interesting that's probably behind this. Is the researcher said, you know what? There might be something else behind what's going on that he'd kind of realise later. What they might be are actually consequences of a drop in something they didn't measure, which would be aggression.
So I want to know, how did they get people to cry? Well, these are emotional tears. They have to be emotional tears rather than just like you punch them in the nose.
No, emotional tears, they put posters up around.
Tears out of people.
Yeah.
Punch them in the nose tears, then there's sailing tears. And then
what they did is they went around the Guardian and asked them about their pay rise. No, they put posters up around the campus, and they said, we want very tearful people, people who are very easily moved to tears, for a study. And say they got about 70-odd responses, one of them being a male.
Women.
Yeah, and then they screened them all to say, because some people think they cry easily, and then turns out that they don't actually cry as easily as they needed them to, because these guys needed to produce tears pretty much on demand, so they were fresh for the studies. Like they're all used within 3 hours of being shed. So they put every one of them in a room on their own and said, what film makes you really cry? Bought the film. They've now got a wonderful library of miserable DVDs.
Miserable movies.
Got all these people to watch the videos. And then they got a select group out of those, 20, 30 people, who cry at the drop of a hat, basically. And they taught them how to use a little mirror and a vial to collect their real tears coming off their cheeks. But then they also had the saline, which they dribbled down their cheeks just in case it picked up any scent from their skin.
Did they have a control movie? Did they show people the same movie?
They had all kinds of different... No, just whatever made them cry. Okay. So they just wanted to get their tears. But then the men who sniffed them, they didn't know if they were sniffing.
The control was the saline.
The control was the saline, but they didn't know what they were sniffing. They didn't know, nor did the experimenters. I mean, so they just had clear liquid. And none of them... They couldn't tell the difference in smell. I mean, they don't smell of anything. But they still believe they find like a small but persistent effect on sexual arousal.
You see, it's women that were crying there, but there are, because men don't cry, obviously, in cinema.
not in part of Glasgow. No,
there are certain rules that allow men to cry at the cinema. When a dog dies, you're allowed to cry. Angelina Jolie takes off her blouse, you're allowed to cry.
You're allowed to cry?
Yeah, if you're a man, and then you can collect the tears. What happens to women? What will they do when they get the male tears? I want to know that.
Can they do the reverse? Does aggression in women reduce when men cry?
But also, are men's tears different to women's tears?
Right. Okay, so there's a lengthy few parts at the end of this paper which say... we do not remotely think that this is unique to women. It is almost certain that these, if there is a chemical or chemicals in there that they're picking up on, it will be in children's tears, it will be in men's tears. And it's harder to do those studies on children for sort of ethical reasons. It's actually harder to do it on men because men do cry emotionally. It's harder to get men to cry emotionally. I mean, I don't know what you would put them in.
Dogs dying at the end.
Your study would take a long time. So they said, look, the only reason we studied women is because it was just... more feasible.
What about happy tears?
It's the beauty of science. We're at the beginning of a whole book of questions. You know?
So when, if someone was to say to you, Ian, this is kind of a dangerously bullshit study that is designed to get headlines, which is going to obviously start debates around, all sorts of places and radio talk shows about how women know this and therefore they use it as a way of controlling men.
I don't care because I think...
you think it was a nicely well-done study?
I mean, I don't know if you know the guy who did it. This guy's called Noam Sobel. He's a neurobiologist. He used to be on the west coast of the States. Incredibly good reputation. He really knows his stuff. And he's one of the most ready to talk about the flaws of his own research in any scientist I've ever spoken to. We actually started the interview talking for about 20 minutes about what might have gone wrong. And he was providing me things like this. I mean, it's in Science, probably one of the best two journals in the world. It's interesting, because The Guardian didn't run the story in the newspaper, and I think probably because they thought, that's bullshit. But there's I think what we have to do as like science reporters is really be aware of when that is an overreaction. And I think this is actually really interesting. And you can't let those kinds of discriminations come in and knock something aside when basically you don't know it's
really
not really for us. It's probably really something really interesting going on there. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Links to all that stuff can be found on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, where you can also subscribe to this podcast so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Right, time to put your coat on. We're going to go for a brisk stroll through a historic part of London. Producer Andy went on a walk around Harley Street and Marylebone to uncover some of its medical landmarks.
Hello, my name is Mary Taylor and I am a Blue Badge guide, and we're going to do a medical walking tour of Marylebone, which will include Harley Street, Wimpole Street, Portland Place, and we'll end up in Regent's Park, where we'll find the Royal College of Physicians. Okay, so we're now in Cavendish Square, and this is really where this whole development started in this area. We had the second Earl of Oxford, a man called Robert Harley, and so this is how we come across Harley Street. But his family were quite extraordinary, and if we actually jump a few generations to the 18th century, we then come to the fourth Earl of Portland. And he was a very, very extraordinary man. At night he used to go out with a servant carrying a lantern 40 feet ahead of him. His staff always had to produce a turkey for him, or every time of day or night, always one had to be roasted ready for him to eat. And also he would carry an opened umbrella so that no one would recognise him in London. I mean, he's extraordinary, isn't he? Right, so if we move on from here, and we've got the Royal College of Dentistry further up, or the British Dental Association. So here we are at number 6 Wimpole Street, outside the home of Sir Frederick Treves, and we've got this lovely blue plaque put up here by English Heritage, so it helps us to know exactly where he lived. And Sir Frederick Treves was literally the leading surgeon of the day. He could command 100 guineas an operation, and he was the very first surgeon in England to do an appendectomy. He also operated on King Edward VII of England 2 days before his coronation, and it was successful. And the next day, Henry VII was sitting up in bed, smoking a cigar, very relieved that he'd postponed his coronation. One day when Sir Frederick Treves walked out of the London hospital, he found in a booth across the road this unfortunate man, known nowadays as the Elephant Man, Joseph Merrick, and it turned out he was very well educated, he could read and write, and also loved going to the theatre. And this, in due course, was to be the cause of his death. Because what happened, one day he went to see Sleeping Beauty and he saw this lovely girl lying down. So he returned to his hospital room, and as he lay down, the weight of his head broke his neck, and that is how he died. Because normally the Elephant Man slept with his knees drawn up to his chin and his chin resting on his knees.
So we're just walking down Wimpole Street, and here's the headquarters of the British Dental Association. What kind of people do you find come on these tours?
We have quite a few medical people coming on these tours, and also people who live locally who really don't know the area. It sort of wakens them up to actually what is around them. Oh, they love them, especially when we've gone into the museums, such as the British Dental Association, because they see things like the Waterloo teeth, they see horrible extractions that used to take place without any anaesthetic. They can see the old treadmills, which were the drills in the old days, so it really does amuse them, and they're, I think, very thankful they're living in this century rather than the 18th century when all these things were happening. We've come into one of the many little mews that are all round this part of London, and this one here in Wimpole Mews is of some political interest. Dr. Stephen Ward, who's an osteopath, he had decided he was the best osteopath in England, and so all the best people came to him: Winston Churchill, Lord Astor, Colin Coutts, the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Roger Hollis, the head of MI5, Anthony Blunt. And one of the things he enjoyed was beautiful young girls. In this little muse here, this is where he'd set them up. John Profumo met Christine Keeler, who was having an affair with Ivan Ivanov, the naval attaché to the Soviet embassy. Profumo also started having an affair with her. And Christine Keeler was basically meant to find out the pillow talk, to find out when Profumo was moving nuclear warheads to Germany. And this scandal all broke. And it all centered around this flat here, which was owned by Dr. Stephen Ward.
So we've reached our main destination. We're now on Harley Street. What's so special about this street then?
Well, Harley Street, first of all, it's beautiful buildings. They really are a delight to behold, mainly what we call Georgian architecture here. And fortunately, as it's now owned by the Howard de Walden estate, I think they're very strict about what they allow to happen here. So the whole area should keep its presence as it is. And of course, you've got the most fantastic selection of medicine, private medicine, obviously. So it's a thriving area and quite a quiet area as well. That's the other lovely thing about Harley Street. It's quiet. On this site is the site of where Florence Nightingale worked before she went to the Crimean War. Sadly for her, she did suffer from what was called Crimean fever, which nowadays they call brucellosis. So when she returned to England, she never ever nursed again, but more or less from her sick bed, set up the nursing profession as we know it today, also moved St. Thomas's Hospital from London Bridge to its present day site, just opposite Big Ben on the south side of the River Thames. Door plates to just see who's specialising in what fields.
So what kind of practices do we have these days? What are most common on Harley Street?
Well, on Harley Street, I think you could say you have everything. Obviously, a lot of plastic surgery goes on here. There's a lot to do with food. People's allergies are here. We've got the big heart hospital here. So again, anything to do with heart surgery, you'd come and see the consultants here. Literally everything you could imagine.
So who's this chap in front of us now?
So in front of us in Portland Place, we have a bust of Lister, Robert Lister, who is the famous surgeon of the day. He was actually the second person to do brain surgery. And also very inventive, he even started working on knees. But the interesting thing about him was that, well, two things. In fact, when he married, he had a three-month honeymoon in Europe, mainly in France and Germany, literally going around to all the medical institutions. So his poor wife was writing all the notes up for him, so very long-suffering. And even when he was doing surgery, and he realised now you had to keep things clean, but he still operated in his blue frock coat, which is quite amazing. I think we're going to have to cross it that way. It always annoys me that pedestrians have to walk further. We've now come to Regent's Park, where you'll find the Royal College of Physicians are housed. Do bear in mind that this wasn't the original site of the Royal College of Physicians. Basically, they were in the city, and the physicians were only given license literally for 7 miles around the city. Their hall was burnt down in the Great Fire of London. In due course, they were even in Trafalgar Square, where the Canadian Embassy now stands. And now, finally, in the 20th century, they moved to this site in Regent's Park. Well, medicine really began in the city. That was the only place that physicians were allowed to practice medicine. Barbers and surgeons could obviously practice out in the fairs as well. And the apothecaries, who would be more or less like the GPs of today, again, there was quite strict ruling as to where they could practice. So very much in the city, medicine has followed where the wealthy people live. Bear in mind, in the old days, there was no state medicine, and so the physicians wanted to make their money, and so it meant they had to live somewhere close to where the wealthy people were living.
medical walks of Harley Street are organised by the Royal College of Physicians and are held every summer. For more details, go to rcplondon.ac.uk. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Ted Neild, Ian Sample, Robin McKee and Nell Bowes. Oh, and while I have your attention, make sure you've listened to our previous podcast, our special from the Large Hadron Collider over Christmas. It was a beautiful programme. We wouldn't want you to miss out. It's full of stuff you just won't hear anywhere else. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can join our Facebook group as well. Just search for the Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth with thanks to Monica Desai. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
So he goes, blah, 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 and I'm the author of the book.
You should probably tell us the title.
Oh, yes. My book is blah, 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 blah.
He's been giving his unorthodox time and even adopt one.
So S-E-A or S-E-E?
S-E-A, sea turtle, as in what these things are. Or sea turtle, yeah, see what you mean. I see what you did there. No, so you can track them.
How long did this take them? You may have mentioned it while I wasn't listening.
So it took about 6 months.
So what speed do they go at? So it takes them six months
to swim 5,000 miles.
Don't go.
So what's that in real money?
It's 1,000 miles a month, roughly.
30 miles a day. It's a mile an hour. It's about a knot. They travel about a knot.
Okay. Thank
what's
you.
That in English terminology?
Can you
that in metric?
Edit this down to make any sense?
No.
Should we start again? What would you like us to start with?
The Street are organised by the Royal College of Physicians and are held every summer. So we're doing it in January. There you are. 6 months to plan your holidays. For more details, go to RCP.
Hang on. The chemical makeup of emotional...
My love is none emotional, of you know what you're talking about.
The chemical makeup of emotional... Robin, you look like you're interested in turtles.
Oh, I see. You've forgotten your question, so I'm going to
throw it
onto
you. Go on. Bring in your knowledge about leatherbacks.
About turtles, yes. Yeah.
You do look like you're interested in turtles. I've never noticed that on your face. About your face. It just says turtle lover.
It says turtle. Yeah, well, I like turtle soup.
It's like an insult. Turtle lover.
So it's the leatherbacks in Finding Nemo that are the hey dude chaps, aren't they?
They're the surfers.
They're the surfer
dudes. That's right. Yeah, well, turtles are cool. We want to see them, don't we?
We do. You're right. That's it. That's all you have to say.
Yes. It's the best I can fill in for
you. The genius of this podcast. Turtles are cool.
Next week, we're going to drill. Next week, stop it. Next week, we grill.
So they haven't been there when the person's originally crying.
So then they wanted something that made everybody sad to see if the tears had an additional effect. I didn't go into it.
So how did they make everybody sad?
By making them watch The Champ.
Which is a 1970s film.
About a washed-up boxer who becomes a horse trainer to make money for his only son, but then dies or something like that. I just read it on Wikipedia.
Is this the neuroscience apparently standard?
Yeah, it is. Apparently it's been
they've
used
got
for
a,
like...
a standard a, crying
it's
film.
Apparently it's been used for like more than a decade as the clip. This guy's death is the clip you use to make people cry.
Good God.
It's astonishing. I'm going to go and look it up on YouTube.
And just have a good cry.
Collect your tears.
I think you probably need to see like a lot of the film before, because if you just see like some
just
bloke
some
you don't
bloke
know
dying.
With like a jockey hat on in a bed dying, and then his like, you know, child, meaningless, isn't it? Oh,
well, let's go and test it out. Our readers can tell us.
Andy's in floods over there just hearing about it.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.